This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you talk about the things that are improving people's lives and making society more prosperous and efficient and fair and promoting individual freedom, then you get into a really different political space.
As wildfires rage out of control for yet another summer, and the Mueller investigation inches ahead at a seemingly glacial pace, there's a lot to be down about when it comes to politics and the environment. But this week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to a journalist who's trying to look at things through a more upbeat lens. By delving into things that should encourage us about our future on this planet, Jeff Dembicki offers plenty of reasons to keep fighting the good fight against climate change. Dembicki sheds some light on issues like housing, education, and the hope of converting climate change deniers in an effort to put a spring in our collective steps, even in the face of some pretty dark times. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeff Dembicki. He's a freelance journalist and an author, and he's based in Vancouver, Canada. Jeff, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So you wrote a book called Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change. It came out last year, but I wanted to talk to you about an article you just published in Vice entitled An Optimist's Guide to Solving Climate Change and Saving the World. It's not a huge departure from the basic thesis of your book, but maybe you can kind of give us a quick overview of the piece, if possible.
Yeah, so I was having these conversations with my editor at Vice about what the world would actually look like if every single political and business leader on the planet decided to address climate change with the seriousness that it deserves. And we kind of ran through the typical solutions. You know, there would be more solar panels and wind turbines, electric cars on all the highways, energy efficient buildings, those sort of technological solutions that come to your mind. But then we started to get really interested in these other solutions that are not as obvious. And so the goal of the story was to go out and to interview people who are thinking about climate change in a way that is not really seen as conventional or mainstream. And these are people who are mainly seeing climate change as a political or social problem instead of just a technological problem. And these people are thinking in terms of, how do we solve climate change in a way that also makes society more equal and reduces some of the extreme disparities in wealth and power that we now see across the planet? And if we approach the issue in that way, what kind of a world are we potentially building? So that was kind of the premise of the story.
And it's ultimately very encouraging. I think it's important to look at problems from through a solution-oriented lens. So let's go through the issues. Mass affordable housing. This is an issue that most people don't think of as a climate change issue, do they?
No, it's not. And it's one that I didn't really think of as a climate change issue either. But what really got me kind of thinking more along these lines is that I live in Vancouver, Canada, which is one of the most unaffordable cities on the planet. And according to its mayor and city council, we're also becoming one of the greenest cities on the planet. And so I thought, you know, this is kind of odd. We're building this sustainable utopia, but then nobody can afford to live in it. So what kind of solution is that? And it turns out that people in expensive urban areas around Canada and the U.S. are also thinking along these lines. So I met this really fascinating organizer and leader named Vian Trung, and I'm sure I butchered her last name. But she had grown up in Oakland, and several years ago, she decided to reach out to a lot of the lower income communities in Oakland and around California and ask them, you know, what would it really take for your communities to become more sustainable? And California, as you know, has passed some of the most ambitious climate change legislation on the planet. And yet, despite that, more and more people are getting around in cars. And so Vian was asking these communities, what do you really need? And what she heard surprised her. Because California's housing prices are increasing so quickly, many lower-income people are being pushed far to the edges of cities, very far away from public transportation, and so they have to drive more. And so not only are they living further and further from their workplaces, they have to spend more and more of their money on gas and maintaining their vehicles, which of course causes more greenhouse gas emissions. And so Vian helped pass this law that redirects some of the money that California is raising from its cap and trade program. It redirects some of that money into funding for solutions in low-income communities. And one of the solutions that that law helps fund is affordable housing near transit. So it allows lower-income people to live closer to public transit and to reduce their impact on the climate.
So you dive into Trung's ideas for California and you talk about this very expensive green building that's popped up recently in Vancouver, which is these sustainable housing models are too often designed for the wealthy, as you note. But what about in the developing world? Did you hear anything from Vian Trung or any other experts about how this mass affordable housing solution might be able to translate into the developing world?
Well, we didn't quite get into the specifics of that, but when I talked to May Bovey, who is the head of 350.org, the climate advocacy group, she was speaking about the rapid spread of decentralized renewable energy in places like Africa, Asia, South America. And what's really interesting about this technology is that it allows villages and areas with a very low standard of living to kind of move quickly into the 21st century and to jump over the old, expensive, centralized fossil fuel business models that we in the West have used to attain our own standard of living. And so you hear this comparison being made all the time to phones. So it's sort of like a village in India, for example, that never had electricity and then goes to renewable energy is like people who never had landlines and jump straight to cell phones. And what's really interesting about this shift is that with the declining cost in solar panels and other renewable forms of energy, you can attain this much higher standard of living at a fraction of the cost that it would take to build like a billion-dollar coal plant and hook all of these areas up to it. And in the process, this kind of changes the structure of decision making and democracy in those areas because the coal plant requires all this investment, which means you're dependent on these powerful companies who can then lobby governments and gain political influence. But if you take that out of the equation, then you're really sort of empowering communities at the grassroots level. And I think as we move into this type of future, it's really going to be fascinating to see the impact that has on our whole process of decision making.
So the housing solution is more of a first world problem in that if we can get more affordable mass housing in countries that have larger carbon footprints already, like the US, if we can kind of roll back the post-World War II exurban, suburban sprawl and concentrate into more efficient urban living situations through affordable housing solutions, then we'll take a nice chunk out of our carbon footprint as a country. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and it kind of, when you think about housing as a climate problem, and I'm not an expert on energy efficient buildings or more efficient materials or anything like that. But what was really interesting in the conversations I was having about this is that you sort of get into a different headspace when you treat housing and climate change in general as a social problem instead of merely, you know, a technological problem for the scientists and inventors and engineers to figure out. So we know, for example, that we need to build much more dense cities. As you say, we kind of need to roll back the suburban experiment that we've been engaged in for the past 50 or 60 years. But the problem that we've seen in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle and Vancouver is that once you start densifying urban cores, that increases the value of land. And then you have all of these developers and investors speculating on land and flipping it many times over, which keeps driving up costs so that after a while, as we see in a city like Vancouver, the only people who can afford to live in these dense urban cores are essentially millionaires. And so if we approach the problem like, well, how do we make this type of denser urban living more affordable, that opens up a whole range of solutions on climate change that weren't even being discussed.
Are my babies coming home tomorrow? Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Babies coming home tomorrow. Ain't that news? Man, ain't that news? I got a letter just the other day telling me that she was on her way and she wanted me to meet her at the station. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and journalist Jeff Dembicki. His latest piece in Vice is entitled An Optimist's Guide to Solving Climate Change and Saving the World. So, Jeff, why did you decide to take on this project? Why take an optimistic look at things?
Well, it's kind of interesting, the timing of this story I did for Vice, because it came out the same day as this massive feature in New York Times Magazine called Losing Earth. And this New York Times feature is a very well-researched, novelistic look at this decade in the late 70s and early 80s when we really had the opportunity to address climate change as a society, and then we didn't take it. So it's a very great piece of writing. It's very fatalistic. It's very depressing. I would recommend it to everybody. And then my story came out, which is this optimistic take about how we can save the world, and there are all these solutions that we haven't looked at, and there's all this momentum underway. And so if you read both pieces like I was doing in preparation for this interview, it almost seems like they were written in totally different universes. But I think the important thing to realize is that if we're going to look at this problem with the clarity we need, only focusing on the hopelessness and the evidence for a doomsday is not presenting a full picture of what's happening. People could make the same argument about my piece and say only looking at optimism and solutions is also not a full picture. And I would say you're right in a way, but I think the more writing that we have about climate change and the more emphasis that we're giving to all aspects of the challenge will greatly improve our ability to do something about it.
So, Jeff, let's turn to your discussion with David Roberts, who's been on Sea Change Radio before. He's a great thinker in the space and a terrific environmental writer. He looks at transportation as being an area that there should be some hope.
Yeah, and kind of the context that David Roberts and I were discussing transportation was kind of as it relates to climate change denial. And I kind of have to step back a couple steps, I think, for that connection to make sense.
Yes, you do start out the piece saying, let's just pretend Trump is gone and it's 2021 and let's kind of start with a fresh slate. So that's right there an optimistic viewpoint, but we should set those terms for our listeners, right?
Yeah, and so I was kind of outlining this scenario to David Roberts. And in his analysis of climate change denial and political polarization, and the one insight that kind of comes out of years of academic research on political polarization and climate change is that the reason so many Americans deny that climate change exists is simply because right-wing elites tell them that climate change doesn't exist and it's a conspiracy invented by liberals. And I know that sounds kind of reductive, but think about how much Republican positions have changed under Donald Trump on things like free trade and whatever else. When you have someone in power telling a huge group of people, this is what conservatives believe, this is what you have to believe to call yourself a Republican, that changes people's viewpoints quite quickly. So if you kind of proceed from that logic, you start to think, well, how could we flip right-wing elites and get them to acknowledge that climate change is urgent and necessary to deal with? Because conceivably, that would cause huge sections of the population to come along with them. And so David Roberts kind of just tossed out the idea of banning gas and diesel-powered cars by, I think, 2035. And that was kind of, you know, just an arbitrary date. And he said, you know, everybody would freak out and people would say, this is impossible. And we're going to have to give up our vehicles. But what we've seen in the past is that when governments set these types of deadlines, there's a giant amount of innovation and investment that follows. And we would see the growth of these new industries, like we're already seeing with Tesla and electric cars. We'd see massive amounts of investment pouring into cleaner technology. And more interestingly, we would see these industries start to gain pretty large political influence and begin lobbying Washington. And Republicans who are on the receiving end of that lobbying would soon come to realize that climate change denial is not a very popular or effective position that's going to give them clout among the business community anymore. So over time, we would start to see climate change denial fade from the discourse. And I know that sounds like a lot of leaps and steps and wishful thinking, but there have been examples in other countries where climate denial flourished briefly, and then when the economics changed, it vanished very fast.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, last year I did a magazine story for Foreign Policy looking at the disappearance of climate change denial in China, for example. In the years that followed Copenhagen, the Chinese leadership decided that climate change was not only urgent to address because of the terrible impacts it would have on China, but also because it could position China to be at the forefront of a new global green economy, and this would be worth billions and billions of dollars. And so the Chinese leadership started moving aggressively, investing giant amounts of money in wind and solar, experimenting with a national cap-and-trade program, incentivizing electric cars. And the climate denial that had been gaining prominence vanished, like, very quickly. And I was interviewing an academic who studies climate denial in China, and he said basically within the space of a year, he couldn't find anybody except a few obscure people on chat rooms discussing this. And now, obviously, China is a much different country than the U.S., but it does show you how fast these things can change once the economic incentives also change.
Let's turn to education for girls. That's something that's really changed the planet already, but you look at this and the people you spoke to look at this as a truly transformational part of human development that will be hand in hand in fighting climate change.
Yeah, and this one was pretty surprising to me, I have to say. When you're thinking of solutions to climate change, education for girls is not really something that pops to the front of your mind, or at least not to mine. And in the course of researching this story, I heard about the work of an environmental researcher and author named Paul Hawken. And he's kind of a legend in environmental circles. A few years ago, he set out to rank the 100 most effective solutions to climate change. And he just wanted kind of, a straightforward list by the numbers. Here are the absolute best things we could do to fight the problem at a global level. And it's interesting that number 6 on that list is expanding access to education for girls, especially in lower income countries. And so you would think, how is that a climate solution? But it turns out when you do the math, women who have more education have more opportunities, and they tend to have fewer children. And so the effect of this is to reduce the stress of humankind on the planet's resources and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And then these women who are better educated and have greater opportunities, they tend to invest more in their own communities, make them more resilient to climate change, and to position them to introduce the type of solutions and changes that we need to see to deal with the problem. And so Hawken kind of ran some numbers on this, and he estimated that when you combine more education with greater resources being put into family planning around the world, this could result in a giant 60 gigaton drop in global emissions. And just to put that in perspective, it's kind of like taking 340 million cars off the road. And so obviously these are big estimates, and there's a lot of assumptions built into it. But once again, it comes back to that idea of looking at climate change as a social problem rather than merely just a problem for inventors and people like Elon Musk to solve. Because when you only look at climate change in that way as more of an engineering technological challenge, you miss out on these broader things that could not only have a massive impact on climate change, but could also really make our world more equal and fairer to live in.
Woke up this morning, I didn't feel that bad. Last night was not the worst I ever had. I ate a nice dinner, drank a few drinks. I didn't miss you, baby, no matter what you think. Went back to my hotel room, went straight to bed. Didn't moan, I didn't cry, I didn't wish I was dead. I'm all right, I'm all right without you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and journalist Jeff Dembicki. So, Jeff, kind of connecting the dots between our political discussion and some of these technological solutions that, and reasons to be optimistic in the fight against climate change, you mentioned Debbie Dooley, who's a Tea Party activist and a big Trump supporter, but also a huge renewable energy advocate in Florida. It sounds like if we can kind of get more Debbie Dooleys, we might be able to kind of bridge the divide. It sounds like solar energy for her was something that appealed to her libertarian streak, that it allowed her to feel that people can be less tied to their utility companies, let's say. Why don't you first explain who she is and then postulate how we can get more of Debbie Dooley's out there from the right wing?
So Debbie Dooley is this Tea Party activist, and she's been involved in that movement for quite a long time. And several years ago, she got really interested in renewable energy, and in particular, rooftop solar. And so that might sound kind of counterintuitive, because, you know, we've come to think of the right wing as being opposed to any type of climate solution whatsoever. But I think what we often forget is that energy has a certain emotional appeal that goes beyond kind of narrow partisan or scientific debates. The reason so many people were drawn to oil and fossil fuels initially is because it really made individuals and communities more free. It gave them, you know, incredible powers to determine their own destiny. And with solar energy, in particular rooftop solar, we're kind of seeing a similar thing happen. You put a solar panel on your roof, suddenly you become self-sufficient. You can disconnect from the grid potentially. You're supplying power to your home. You're not reliant on a large, inefficient utility, or even a central government to some extent. So this really kind of plays into a libertarian worldview, and also has the benefit of being really good for the planet. And so Debbie Dooley, like a lot of conservatives and libertarians in sunny states like Georgia and Arizona and Florida, got really excited by this technology. And then as more and more people were putting solar panels on their rooftops, the utilities got concerned that that was going to hurt their business model. And so the utilities tried to force through legislation that would make rooftop solar more expensive, more difficult to install. And so that got Debbie Dooley really upset. And so she started organizing coalitions of people to fight back against that. But what I found, especially with this story and in other stories where I've written about solutions, is that when you talk about the things that are improving people's lives and making society more prosperous and efficient and fair and promoting individual freedom, then you get into a really different political space.
Jeff Dembicki, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band, Sam Cook, and Mose Allison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.